This is Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a proposed multi-million dollar development on the site of the Woodstock 94 festival in Saugerties is sparking debate. Developers say the mixed-use development at Winston Farm will grow the economy while preserving open space. Local residents are skeptical. We speak to Catskill Mountain Keeper about the environmental concerns. The National Canoe Safety Patrol ensures the well-being of all who explore the Upper Delaware River. We'll speak to members of the Safety Patrol about their legacy of water safety and camaraderie of passionate paddlers. And we'll stay on the river to tell the oral history of the river, preserving over 40 years of oral history through the voices of the region's residents and former park employees, plus the latest at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan wrapped up talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing today. While both countries promoted unity and cooperation as a stable source of world peace, Sullivan made it clear that he was there for the American people and U.S. allies.
The United States has and will continue to advance its interests and values, look out for its friends. And as we do, we believe that competition with China does not have to lead to conflict or confrontation.
The two sides discussed a range of topics, including China's role in assisting Russia's war in Ukraine and easing tensions in the South China Sea. A jury in Las Vegas has convicted former county official Robert Tellis of murder. NPR's Martin Costi reports prosecutors say Tellis killed a reporter in 2022 over a series of unflattering newspaper articles.
Former Clark County Public Administrator Robert Tellis was found guilty of murdering a reporter, Jeff Gehrman of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, in September of 2022. That was after Tellis had lost his reelection bid. During the sentencing phase of the trial, prosecutor Christopher Hamner told the jury to keep in mind that Gehrman had been killed after reporting on misconduct by Tellis.
What happened here was literally a journalist wrote a story or a series of stories and lost their life over it. That's a pretty serious thing.
47-year-old Tellis said in court that he believed he'd been framed by the police. The jury sentenced him to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 20 years. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street opened higher this morning as gross domestic product data showed the U.S. economy going slightly stronger than initially reported. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 145 points in early trading.
Tech traders are recovering from a sell-off of AI darling NVIDIA after the chip company reported a slower increase in sales than expected, though its sales and earnings essentially doubled. They just face sky-high expectations. The company's stock tumbled after markets closed yesterday. Meanwhile, software giant Salesforce raised its forecast for the year, sending its shares up. Dollar General shares plunged after the chain slashed its outlook for the year, saying it expects sales to grow but very little as its key shoppers are feeling, quote, financially constrained. By contrast, Best Buy raised the financial forecast for the year, saying that its shoppers are still hunting for sales but also willing to splurge extra on newer tablets, laptops, and computers. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
Stocks continue to trade higher on Wall Street, the Dow up 175 points, the Nasdaq up 170. This is NPR News. Flight attendants with United Airlines are threatening to walk off the job. The president of the flight attendants union says members voted almost unanimously to authorize a strike if the airline doesn't increase their benefits. In addition to a bump in pay, employees are demanding better retirement plans and job security. Extreme wildfires in Canada last year released a significant amount of heat-trapping emissions. NPR's Lauren Summer reports a new study finds it's almost as much as the annual emissions from many developed countries.
Canada's fire season last year was the hottest and driest since 1980. That led to almost 58,000 square miles burning. When forests burn, they release carbon dioxide, the same heat-trapping gas that comes from burning fossil fuels. Scientists at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory calculated the emissions from Canada's fires in 2023. They found it's close to the fossil fuel emissions from a big industrialized country. Only three countries emitted more. Since trees absorb and store carbon, they're an important solution for slowing climate change. More wildfires could hamper the ability of forests to do that. Lauren Summer, NPR News.
At least three people are dead after a powerful typhoon made landfall in southern Japan. The storm came ashore, bringing heavy rain and high winds, leaving thousands of people without power. Hundreds of flights have been canceled. Some high-speed train services have also been suspended. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil Pure Z's Gummies, designed with melatonin for occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep naturally. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In 1994, the Winston Farm property in Saugerties, New York, made international headlines when it hosted the 25th anniversary of the Woodstock Festival, the so-called middle child to the other festivals of 1969, here down the road in Bethel, and 1999. Over the years, several plans for the property were proposed that ultimately failed to come to fruition, including a community college, a casino, a landfill and incinerator, and a high-tech business park. Now the latest plans for the property were presented during a meeting for the Saugerties Town Board earlier this month, and in that proposal for the 840-acre project included are 799 housing units with a combination of townhouses and apartments serving an estimated 1,746 residents. Also included in the plan would be 250,000 square feet of commercial space, a 150-room boutique hotel, a conference center with a further 250 hotel rooms, a 5,000-seat enclosed performance space, 100 cabins on a campground, and around 250,000 square feet of laboratory or light industrial space. The developers say the proposal will grow the local economy and add jobs, and that the new proposal has addressed concerns raised since their first draft plans were submitted nearly 3 years ago. Others say they feel differently. That includes Catskill Mountain Keeper, the environmental advocacy organization. They say the proposed development of Winston Farms stands to jeopardize the health and safety of nearby residents. Joining us now from Catskill Mountain Keeper is Senior Research Director Kathy Nolan. Kathy, good morning.
Good morning.
So I detailed some of the big plans for this 840-acre project. Is that what you understand this revamped proposal from the developers to be for Winston Farm?
Yes, this site has been a historic site, and it's been a very valuable site to the community, being studied and looked at a lot. This newest version of the new proposal is quite a bit of development, as you describe. 799 houses, conference center, multiple hotels, cabins, and this is the preferred development plan that the owners of this property are offering at present, but actually even this isn't completely locked in. So the review of this project is complicated, but really needs to be done well, because it's been a shifting target already, and this proposal comes in the context of a proposal to rezone the area to allow these types of activities.
Yeah, this is technically a draft generic environmental impact statement, DGEIS, that was presented to the town board by the developers. The developers say that they changed some of their initial plans, which, as I mentioned, were first proposed about 3 years ago following what they say is extensive research. That original plan included a water park and an outdoor adventure park. They've scrapped that. But despite these revisions, folks remain skeptical. What are the reactions and concerns here?
Well, this proposal and the DGEIS, to unpack those letters for people, this is part of the New York State required environmental review. And an EIS part of it is the environmental impact statement. The generic part is related to the fact that this environmental review is actually on the zoning change that's being proposed here and the creation of this new plan development district. And this is a draft. Now, what the town of Saugerties has to do, since they're leading the environmental review, is decide within 45 days of receiving this whether it is complete and addresses all the issues that need to be addressed. It needs to be complete in terms of both its scope and its content. And I think that it's this document that we have has some real deficiencies in terms of all of that. The developers did propose this bigger list of over a dozen things that they might do at the site, and now they've taken off some of those or downsized them somewhat. But that initial description and list was just completely hypothetical. You know, go and ask and see if anybody in the area would like any of these offerings at this site. And this new version is a little bit more developed than that in terms of now proposing the western part of the property to be preserved more as open space and the development to be concentrated on the eastern part. So that's a little more clarity about where everything might happen. But the list of what could happen in some of these newly zoned areas are pretty scary.
And what is
perimeter commercial area could include sports arenas, resorts, breweries, health clubs, medical clinics. So the area is basically the size of a small town, the village of Saugerties, and their draft here that would go along with the new zoning would allow for some water, and it wasn't clear that there would be enough water to do the new development and give the village of Saugerties the water that they actually need. This revised proposal now has the development site itself, plus maybe a private well nearby owned by one of the owners of the development supplying the water. And it would probably have a central water system, although the way this is currently written, it would allow for private wells it's consistent with this. There's no requirement for a central water distribution system, no requirement for a central sewer system, and those are two things that are usually required if you're going to allow a piling up of density of large amounts of houses and buildings in an area. You usually want to have that centralized systems, and that's not specified here. And yes, you're right. This area is the recharge area for the aquifer that they're planning to draw on and that supplies the town and village of Saugerties. And there's an aquifer protection layer. It's not clear to me how the aquifer is protected when you build in as much new structures as they're proposing here and impervious surface area.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Senior Research Director Kathy Nolan from Catskill Mountain Keeper about the proposed development of Winston Farm, the historic site of Woodstock 94. It's generating significant debate within the Saugerties community. What does Catskill Mountain Keeper propose or recommend for this latest proposal or for the proposal of the farm development itself?
Well, there's what would be ideal, which would be taking this land and making it available to land conservation groups that could do things like protect it long term. There's been talk about whether or not this area could be a state park and have the historic buildings in directly incorporated into that. That would, of course, require the current owners of the property to be willing to do that. Their proposal mentions the historic sites and lists them and says that they would not be disturbed, but there's no proposal to incorporate them in any way that then makes them a central feature and a continuing community benefit and resource. So between a future in which that land could come to New York State and become protected for all of the people in New York State to use and enjoy, and what they currently propose, there would be the town of Saugerties really requiring more here that would protect the land if it is going to be developed. And this document that we have is a first step, but the town board is not required to accept it as is. They can require changes. And I think that changes that head in the direction of getting clearer about the open space and how it's used actually to protect habitats, not just fields or the edges of people's lawns, but real protected habitat, and deal more specifically with the water and sewer issues, traffic. The intent here, as articulated, is to benefit the town, but the members of the community have basically been receiving documents that describe what the developers want, and there hasn't been a forum developed where people in the village could talk about which of these proposed things they might want. Doing all of them just makes it so oversized and the impact so much more potentially harmful.
The developers purchased Winston Farm in 2020. They're on their website, local residents and business owners, they say, and they say that they purchased the property, quote, in recognition of the need to preserve the property, ensure it retains the local character that in so many ways symbolizes the Hudson Valley. That's on winstonfarm.com, which is the website of the developers, owners of that property. But, even if they're local members and they're claiming they want to preserve this property, there's still these environmental concerns that you and others have?
Yeah, I think that the idea of doing something good with this property is right, and it's easy to articulate. And then we're getting these proposals, which look like they're driven by more traditional development goals, how to maximize economic benefit from the property. And there's attention in this, the draft environmental document, to the potential benefits to the town of Saugerties, economic benefits. But it's not clear to me that the residents of Saugerties would be willing to trade their quality of life for these hypothesized economic benefits and how they actually come in and serve the community really hasn't been fully articulated. Because this is a proposal to rezone, there's actually a worst case scenario, or what the document calls a reasonable worst case scenario. That is the worst case scenario that we can imagine. And this is even more than what the sponsor's preferred plan is. It's almost a million cubic yards of fill and 500,000 yards of cut. That's a huge amount of tearing up of at least part of this 840 acres. And it just seems like going to those extremes, allowing in this aquifer overlay zone, in a gateway zone recognized for its tourism benefit to the region, that the zoning should try to improve from what the current zoning is, not let more development than the current current zoning would allow.
Project spokesman Josh Summers said, quote, the process will be very community oriented. The process, as we've discussed, is now before the town board. It's a DGEIS, draft generic environmental impact statement. What happens next? There's a 45-day period. Will there be, for review, will there be public comment?
There isn't a required public comment during that 45-day window for the town board to determine whether or not the draft is complete. If they determine it's complete, either at the end of that 45 days or later if they decide revisions are needed, once it has been accepted, then there will be a public comment period. And the town board, as the lead agency for this review, can also hold a hearing. That is not required. And following some iterations of public comment and hearings, then the town would make findings about a final generic environmental impact statement.
And how can folks get more information and learn more?
There are groups in the community that are working on this. The group Beautiful Saugerties is taking the lead on that. We have information on Catskill Mountain Keepers website, and the both the town of Saugerties and the project sponsors have documents regarding the review of this project.
And before I let you go, just bringing it back to the Woodstock aspect of it, the Winston Farm host of Woodstock 94, we're here near the site of the original 1969 Woodstock Festival. That property was redeveloped into Bethel Woods, a performing arts venue. I don't know the entire history of the project. I am sure there were some debate about it. But in the end, it seems to have been respectful of the land, the place, and the space. Would you like to see something like that at Winston Farm?
Yes, I think that what the process and the outcome at Bethel Woods is really something to look towards. While you could say that there may have been ways to improve that process as well, the goal was to preserve the site for what made it special. And this site is special for Winston, for the Winston Farms buildings and the Woodstock Anniversary Festival, and the historic buildings and use of the site, as well as the sledding hill, which this new proposal does leave intact, but leaves it intact, but without any clear use or how it would be made available. The idea of taking this and making it into a state park seems to me to be more in keeping with the model of Bethel Woods, where you're going to make a special site special and keep it available to the public rather than exploit the land to build buildings and even residences. So there's room to do some things on this site. It's a lot of acreage, and still have more of it serve the history and the ecology and the community character.
That's Kathy Nolan, Senior Research Director at Catskill Mountain Keeper. We've been talking about the proposed development of the Winston Farm property in Saugerties. You can learn more about Catskill Mountain Keeper's work at catskillmountainkeeper.org. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, preserving the oral history of the Upper Delaware River. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, a newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjayville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Last week on Wait, Wait, Dulce Sloan took a moment to appreciate President Biden's vibe.
Yeah. Ah, baby, he had the energy of somebody who quit a job, but the job don't know yet.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, we're heading to Minnesota to do our job because with Tim Walz as governor, it's the dad joke capital of the world. Join us for this week's Minnesota Nice News Quiz from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. The Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River Oral History Project is an ambitious project preserving over 40 years of oral histories through the voices and memories of the region's residents and former park employees. On September 5th, the Upper Delaware Council is spotlighting the Oral History Project with a public presentation led by Alejandro Garcia Maldonado, cultural resource specialist at the National Park Service Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River, along with Avery Olliger, intern cultural research management program assistant. Alejandro Garcia Maldonado joins us now with more on this significant project. Alejandro, thanks for joining us.
Tim, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this project.
You have a tongue twister of a title, but it's all good because you're the cultural resource specialist. Tell us about the inspiration for creating this Upper Delaware Oral History Project, and how has it evolved?
Well, you know, this project extends, you know, at this point, pretty much a generation, a couple of decades plus. It's been carried over by a few of my predecessors. But the person credited pretty much for starting this program here and this project was Mary Curtis. She was the park historian for a long time, and she's still an active historian here in the area.
And when you're, you know, trying to preserve so many years of oral history, what are some of the challenges you've kind of faced in managing and also expanding this project, particularly in making these stories accessible to the public?
Well, you know, as you may know, and some of the audience may know, you know, oral histories are a different type of primary source. This is, you know, it's based on, you know, there's some level of emotion, there's some level of memory, there's, you know, a big part of perspective. Here, you know, in preserving the histories, you know, there are challenges, you know, and in order to share these materials with researchers or the public, we need to have releases. And so sometimes if there's difficulties in getting releases, people pass on, people move out of the area. We've had, you know, our materials are kept in an environmentally controlled environment. So they're safe. But however, we've had issues where materials had been transferred from audio cassette to a digital format, and then we've lost them and had to recover them. Other challenges are at times, you know, finding folks that still want to share their history, or folks that have a level of history here locally.
And what are some of the most memorable or impactful stories you've encountered so far in this oral history collection of the Upper Delaware River and the region?
Sure. Well, we've got a few about some of our archaeology that we have here. We have a couple that were, you know, pretty amusing, lifelong NPS employees that are telling us, you know, anecdotes from, you know, different parks and their experiences. But, you know, overall, it's all really, you know, interesting, and it draws you in because you're hearing the perspective of a person who was there during a historical event. You know, you're hearing history from a historical actor themselves.
Yeah, and our folks, you said it was hard to perhaps, or challenging to find folks that still want to tell their story. But once you get to them and tell them what you're doing, are they willing and ready to share?
Well, see, that's part of the next steps here with this project. See, we've got we're doing it by themes. So at this point, the oral histories that we've centered on are, as you mentioned before, NPS employees and former employees of UPD, that's the acronym for our park, the Upper Delaware. And then we're moving on from there to local histories and expanding from there. So we're actually both, you know, we've been recruiting volunteers to come on and help with this project. But we're also still looking for what we call in the business, quote unquote, narrators who want to tell their story.
So you're putting out a call for those folks as well at this event on the 5th, but just in general?
Well, the event on the 5th is more talking about the process of what Avery did during his internship and about the project overall. You know, we've got an interest in any folks who may want to tell some of their history in the area. However, it's not necessarily a general call per se. If someone really has something they want to share with us, we would definitely be more than willing to collect that oral history as well.
Well, special shout out to Avery and the work that's going to be presented on the 5th at the Upper Delaware Council. Can you tell folks a little bit more about the event? I understand it's in person and also virtual.
Yes, it's their monthly general meeting, and they typically have a speaker come in and give a presentation at the beginning of the meeting. So for this month's general meeting, Avery will be presenting on the work he did here at the Upper Delaware with cultural resources.
And folks can get more information at upperdelawarecouncil.org. We've been speaking to Alejandro Garcia Maldonado, Cultural Resource Specialist at the National Park Service Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Alejandro.
Thanks for having me, Tim. You have a great rest of your day.
You too. We'll take a break, and we're staying on the river. We're going to talk river safety with the National Canoe Safety Patrol. This is Radio Chatsco.
Every few weeks on the Mike and Load of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we take a listen to one of Britain or Ireland's finest songwriters. This week it's the Scottish marvel that is Corinne Polwart. So join me, please, for the songs and singing of Corinne Polwart on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Join us for Radio Catskills 2024 Community Awards, September 12th, honoring individuals dedicated to environmental stewardship and sustainability, including Lori Ramey of the Upper Delaware Council and Lisa Lyons of Morgan Outdoors. Celebrate their hard work and commitment to healthier and more sustainable local communities at the 2024 Radio Catskill Community Awards, September 12th at La Sagone, Narrowsburg. Get your tickets now at wjffradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The National Canoe Safety Patrol was established in 1979 to pioneer water safety with a history rooted in community, responsible paddling, and continuous commitment to evolving safety standards. Their mission is to ensure the safety of everyone who enjoys the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River, and they promote responsible and sustainable recreational use of the waterways. Joining us this morning from the NCSP, see that I'm cool, I know the acronym, are Corinne Hinton, Andrea Alberti Coleman, and NCSP member and Radio Catskill volunteer Tom Candela. Good morning to all of you. Hello.
Good morning, and thank you for that introduction, Tim.
Well,
I mean,
listen,
that was perfect. I don't even know if you need us now.
All right,
well,
thanks for coming.
Okay. All right, I'll see you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Well, let's talk a little bit about what you guys do. You are a volunteer organization that partners with the National Park Service, the Upper Delaware Scenic Recreational River. We just had on Alejandro from of the Park Service. What do you guys do to help with river safety on the Upper Delaware?
Yeah, so let me just give you a little bit of background about the partnership between the National Park Service and the National Canoe Safety Patrol. So again, my name's Corinne, and I'm the Community Volunteer Ambassador at Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River, and we are a unit of the National Park Service. My job there is to manage our volunteer and parks program And so I manage about 125 volunteers among six different volunteer opportunities. Mm-hmm. And one of the most important volunteer opportunities we have is our partnership with the National Canoe Safety Patrol. And so they actually directly impact the safety of our visitors on the water. And that's why I'm here with Andrea and Tom today, so they can tell you more about the organization.
I grouped you all together. Sorry.
Yeah.
I put you all in the same boat.
I love that.
Very good. A little humor.
And had my coffee.
Yeah. So Andrea and Tom are going to tell you more about the organization and the importance and how you can get involved.
All right. Let's pass it on over to Tom.
Very good. So, Tim, again, you did a great job of introducing us. Tell us a little bit about the history. So just so everyone knows, we have been around for 45 years. Okay. Back in 1978, a gentleman by the name of Chris Nielsen had this idea that there needed to be a little bit more safety on the river, and how could he contribute to that. So he got together with other groups, the Philadelphia Canoe Club, the Mohawk Canoe Club, Garden State Canoe Club, and other chapters of the Appalachian Mountain Club. And together they formed this organization and based on this idea of providing river safety. By 1979, they had their first spring training. And which we do every year now. What is it?
The first week in May.
The first week in May. And they started patrolling the river. Now, we have been involved in many different aspects of river safety and providing group safety to other groups. So, for instance, back in 1992 and 96, the NCSP, the National Canoe Safety Patrol, was part of the team that worked with the Olympic trials for kayaking. So they provided safety for groups like that. Today, we're about 80, 85 members strong. And what we're here today for is to let people know not only about who we are and what we do, but also that we're actively looking for new volunteers, whether they be young or old, where we have a room for everybody.
And what are some of the volunteer opportunities? Of course, we're stressing river safety. We're stressing being on the water, but there are opportunities on and off river.
Correct. Correct.
There are. What are some of those opportunities?
Okay. So if paddling is not your cup of tea, and by the way, it could be paddling in a canoe or paddling in a kayak. We have a good mixture right now of both type of paddlers.
Can I just interject? We got two paddle boarders this year.
Right, we did.
So paddle boarding as well.
And paddle boarding as well. Yeah. So, other opportunities are you can provide safety from the shore, you know, with a throw bag or that sort of thing, river safety in that way. There are outreach opportunities where you can promote NCSP to the general public. There we have the need for people who could shuttle us back and forth. Again, this is if you're not interested in being on the water itself. But a lot of people are, and a lot of people serve multiple roles in that. So we're a pretty tight-knit organization. And we welcome anyone and everyone. In fact, we have members from diverse backgrounds, anywhere from fire and medical personnel, professionals, educators, factory workers, business owners, teachers. And we have even a couple of kids involved.
And how does this work then as a volunteer? Say I'm joining and I'm joining the river patrol on the river as a paddler. You'll probably help me with some river paddling skills and safety.
Absolutely.
But do you guys organize like specific shifts for patrols? Or how does that work in terms of patrolling the river for river safety?
That's a really good question. I'm a relatively new member. I just joined last year. So I come with the energy and excitement of a new member. But what we do is we sign up for the weekends that we think we can patrol, and we drive up to Zane Grey Museum in Lackawaxen, where we all meet at between 9 and 9:30 every weekend morning. And the National Park Service will give us safety bags and extra park radios so we can stay in communication. And they will, based on the information we've received from the different outfitters, how many boats are launching from which place, whether they're canoes, kayaks, whether it's a real busy river day. And then they'll suggest where we can go. We can generally have a choice. There are four to five different sections.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, we just heard a few days ago, another person unfortunately drowned on the river. A 39-year-old man from New Jersey drowned after pushing his two children to safety from the river before succumbing to the current himself. That was near the Delaware Water Gap. And that's the third drowning death this summer.
Yes.
Corinne, we talk about this every summer. We can't stress enough the importance of river safety. Can you talk a little bit about the river itself?
Yeah, so the river is unpredictable, and there are swift currents underneath those waves that you see there. And so it's really important that you're always wearing a life jacket on the river. The current laws are that children 12 years of age and younger must be wearing a properly fitted life jacket at all times while on the river. And anyone over the age of 12 must have a properly fitted life jacket with them in arm's reach at all times. And so it's very important that you're taking care of your own water safety, because we can't always have rangers there to save people. And that's why it's really important that we have volunteers like the National Canoe Safety Patrol, so they can be out there educating others on the dangers of the river and how they can protect themselves.
Exactly.
I was just going to ask about that. There aren't enough of you rangers to patrol this huge river from right. all the way up here in New York, all the way down to Pennsylvania and further into Delaware, obviously. But in our section, even, how many folks are from the NPS or from the ranger side are there to patrol?
Yeah. So the Upper Delaware River is about 73.4 miles long. And in our corridor there, we usually have about 4 to 6 rangers patrolling the river every day. And that's definitely not enough rangers. That's why it's really important we have NCSP as well.
And how many people are using that on a weekend and like going into a holiday weekend, Labor Day weekend coming up? How many people are going to be out there?
Right. It's hard to tell because people can get in the river at other locations, not just where the National Park Service is stationed. But our rangers do see about 500 contacts a day just at their singular stations. So we are seeing thousands of people getting on the river every day.
Right.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Tom Candela, Andrea Alberti Coleman, and Corinne Hinton.
Very good.
We're talking about the National Canoe Safety Patrol and their partnership with the National Park Service on the Upper Delaware for water safety as we're heading into this Labor Day weekend, stressing the importance of water safety and the importance of volunteering to help do that. So to supplement what we've heard from Corinne about the number of rangers that are allotted to that area, and you guys have what you said about 100 strong volunteer group.
Yeah, about 80 right now, and we are looking for more.
You're looking for
volunteers.
More.
And let me just throw in our... If you don't mind, I want to throw in our website.
Well, of course. Okay? We're going to let people know how to get involved.
Exactly.
That's the point of our whole conversation.
It's nationalcanoesafetypatrol.org.
One more time.
Okay? That's nationalcanoesafetypatrol.org. And you go on that website, and you'll see there'll be a contact tab there, and you basically fill out the information, and someone will get back to you very quickly, within a day or so. And, you know, we'll let you know a little bit more about how you can get involved and what's involved in getting involved. For instance, our training sessions, we have this every year. It is the first weekend in May. Thank you. First weekend in May. And we learn about river safety, of course, but we do things like how to overturn and to right an overturned canoe, how to rescue people out of the water. We have a first aid course. We have a CPR course. All these things are part of our training. But a lot of people, some people can't make that training. And so during the regular season, we have ongoing training that can happen while on the river with your mentor, because everyone's hooked up. New members are hooked up with a mentor.
So if somebody heard that website you just gave and go on, could they get some training now? Or what's the next steps in terms of somebody volunteering now as we end this summer season?
Well, that's a great question. So if you were to volunteer now, probably we would invite you to come to one of our patrols over the coming weekends. For instance, this weekend, we have a 3-day weekend. So there'll be, you know, patrols each one of those days. We would invite you to come on one of those, and you would be paired with somebody who is one of our more senior members of the group. And you would basically just paddle with them for the day. There would be some, you know, basically to see where your skills are, you know, how comfortable you are paddling, how comfortable you are in the water. And so then we would determine, you know, what your needs are based on that. And then the Park Service, and we're hoping this will expand this into next year, is going to be offering throughout the year additional training. Is that right, Corinne? Is that the plan?
Yes. So I know that NCSP offers their training and CPR course right in the beginning of the spring there, but we will also try to offer CPR courses throughout the summer as well.
Right. And
go ahead.
And one of the things we actually do in a group is we'll, you know, when it's a little of a lull time and nobody's coming downriver at the moment and we're sitting there waiting, we get out our throw bags, you know, we get out, let's get in the water and get, you know, get back into the canoe or flip that canoe over and ride it again. So things like that is sort of an ongoing training. And I also want to stipulate that, you know, a lot of people say, well, I don't have the equipment. I don't have a kayak. You don't need it. You know, we do have loaner equipment. So for folks who are just beginning, you know, you can borrow our equipment from everything from PFDs to paddles, to throw bags to actual boats. We do have available. So don't worry about, you know, whether or not you have to spend a lot of money right away to buy all this equipment. It's not necessary. We have it as loaners.
Andrea, I wanted to ask you, what does it mean for you as a new volunteer, especially being part of such a public service focused group community?
It is so powerful. I love it. I love the group. I love the people I patrol with and that I camp with, because the National Park graciously provides our club with a campsite at Kittatinny. So we have a great time at camp too, off river. When we're not on patrols, there's this growing community of like-minded, service-oriented people we're out there to help others, but we're also helping ourselves by helping others. We're gaining those deep connections and friendships with others.
There's a really great sense of camaraderie with the group.
Absolutely is. And it's a great opportunity too for parents with their children, because we've had volunteers as young as 10 years old be part of NCSP. Now, again, their activities are somewhat limited by their abilities, but what a great way for a parent to be on the river with their child, to introduce them to volunteerism, introduce them to water safety, and to be stewards of this great natural resource that we are so fortunate to have in our backyard. I mean, when I'm on the river, I look around and I think all the time, I live here.
Yeah.
I live here.
We all kind of have that moment, right?
Yeah.
And for you guys to be out there and helping just, you know, make sure people have a great time on that river, that they're being safe on that river and preserving that for everybody while having a sense of fun yourselves.
Absolutely.
That sounds great. Absolutely. One more time with that website if folks want to learn more.
Absolutely. It's the NationalCanoeSafetyPatrol.org. Simply go there, and we hope you do. We're really looking forward to, particularly people locally. You know, we have folks that come from hours away on some of these weekends, and it's, you know, it gets harder and harder on some of them. So we're really looking for local volunteers who love this resource, love the river, love the outdoors, and want to be part of combining all of that and joining the National Canoe Safety Patrol. So that would be the NationalCanoeSafetyPatrol.org.
And if you stuck around long enough and rose up through the leadership ranks, you could become Commodore, which is like a cool name.
We do have a Commodore. We do. I mean,
I know. You have a Vice Commodore and a Commodore. That's cool.
We have a Commodore, Vice Commodore, and we have other officer positions.
Leadership roles.
And leadership roles. So it's well organized.
Well, thank you guys for coming in. We appreciate it. And that is Tom Candela, Andrea Alberti Coleman from the National Canoe Safety Patrol, and Corinne Hinton from the National Park Service. One more time, reminding folks, please wear your life jacket.
Absolutely.
Be safe on the river. And thank you all for doing what you do and for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, what's happening at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse in Delaware County? This is Radio Chatsco.
It's another music yard sale happening 9 to 3 this Saturday at Radio Catskill in Liberty. Records, CDs, cassettes, turntables, stereos. It's all priced to move, so bring a big vehicle and load up. The Music Yard Sale, 9 to 3 Saturday at Radio Catskill in Liberty. See you there.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Rock Valley Schoolhouse is a former one-room church in Delaware County, former one-room schoolhouse, excuse me, now a music venue. On Sunday, they're presenting, get this, it's a neuroscientist and musician, Joseph Ledoux, reading excerpts from his in-progress memoir titled Starting Over. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi has more.
Good morning, Joseph, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're no stranger to WJFF, correct?
We've been in the area for 33 years, not full-time, but a long time.
So you are going to be performing at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse in Long Eddy, and that is on this Sunday, September 1st at 4 p.m., and that is on Highway 28 in Long Eddy. And if folks go online to the Rock Valley Schoolhouse, they'll be able to find directions. Tell us about what you're planning.
Yeah, so I'm a neuroscientist by trade.
Yes.
I've been working on the brain for many years, and I've written a bunch of books about it. But right now I'm working on a memoir that includes my scientific research, but also my adventures as a musician to some extent. And also, it also includes my growing up in South Louisiana. My parents were officially Cajuns, and I guess I am as well. And it's a whole different way of living than people are used to. Not everyone understands exactly what a Cajun is, but in the memoir I will describe all that. Well, yeah, so I thought I would read the introduction to the memoir, which is, it covers the fact that I sort of accidentally became a neuroscientist. It's not something I planned. I had 2 degrees in business administration and marketing from Louisiana State University. And I was kind of bored with it. It was the 60s, and it wasn't that cool to be in business. So I took a bunch of psychology courses because that seemed more interesting. And I happened to take one that I thought was about human motivation, but it turned out to be about rat brains and memory. And I kind of fell in love with that idea. And back then, there was no field of neuroscience per se. And so I just kind of was able to slip right into a PhD, and 4 years later I had my degree, and from then on just kept going on and on, and that's what I've done the rest of my life is studied the brain. I study emotion and memory in particular. So it was a kind of accidental falling into that path, and that's why the book is called Starting Over, if I ever finish it. But it will be about these kinds of accidents of life and how things happen and sort of determine the rest of your life without you knowing that it actually happened.
Well, it's a coincidence in your life that you grew up touching brains, correct?
I see you've done your homework, yeah.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, well, as a kid, my father was a butcher, and my job was to pull the brains pull the bullets out of the brain after the animals had been uttered, and people were eating brains back then. It was before mad cow disease, and
yes.
So my job was to kind of like remove the brain, move the bullet as carefully as I could so I wouldn't mess up the brain tissue and make it look ugly and kind of mangled where I didn't pull it up. But that had nothing to do with my career becoming someone who studied the brain. It's just like, you know,
I know, but it's just an interesting little backstory. It is. And the fact that you grew up in Cajun country, and as a neuroscientist, you still had this feel for music in your soul.
Louisiana music is, but it's not something I loved as a kid, called Cajun culture. It's like it felt like old music and stuff. But in retrospect, you know, I've come to appreciate it and really, really have very warm feelings about it. There's a group that from my hometown that comes up to New York all the time, and they're playing in at the end of next week in Brooklyn, so I'm going to go see them.
And you had a group called the Amygdaloids, and I believe you performed up here.
I've performed up here at the schoolhouse many times, probably I'd say over 9 years or so. I'm not sure the Amygdaloids have We never have performed as a band up here, but Colin Dempsey and I, he's also in the band, do a kind of duo thing where we play folk versions or acoustic versions of our songs. You know, the Amygdaloids invented their own genre called heavy mental, because it was all about mind and brain and mental disorders.
I think, you know, it's funny because when I was writing notes down, I instead of writing heavy mental, of course, I wrote heavy metal.
It's kind of a play on words.
Yes, yes. And how long have you been playing with Colin?
I think he probably started around 2012.
Because I met Colin over at the Red Rose, where he bartends.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great.
Yes, and he's a delightful bartender.
He's a wonderful, wonderful person.
He is. You know, you can feel it.
He's amazing.
Yes.
My wife calls him my second wife because I'll often be invited to give lectures like in Europe or like we were just in Brazil.
Right. He told me about that.
Can you bring the band? I said, no, but I can bring Colin. So Colin has become my road wife in a sense. We travel together, and we have these great gigs. We played in Rio and Rome, Mexico City, Stockholm. It's been kind of a weird, wonderful interaction or integration of music and science.
Now, will we be hearing some of your older songs as well as some of your newer ones on Sunday?
So in addition to me doing the reading from the potential memoir, I will play a recording of six songs that are streamed together in a continuous a set of sounds. The name of the album, if it ever comes out, will be Songs of Life. And so the songs are connected by moments of other things, just as in life, how you just move from one time zone to another and in your life, one time spot into the next. And so the songs do that too. They're not necessarily continuous in terms of their themes, but they're all about life in one way or another. And then after I play that 15-minute segment, then I'll play a couple of songs from what would be the B-side or the flip side of that album, Songs of Love, and play a couple of love songs. And Colin and I will play some heavy metal songs together.
Oh, good.
We'll probably play some of our greatest hits, like My Mind's Eye and Map of Your Mind. All the songs are about the mind in one way or another.
It sounds like a very intriguing performance. And let me just sum this up for folks. That's at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse in Long Eddy. And it's Sunday, September 1st at 4 p.m. And if you haven't been to the Rock Valley Schoolhouse, it's an absolutely delightful space. You are brought back at least 100 years.
And you hear an amazing sound because the acoustics in that schoolhouse are like no other place you've ever been. It's just amazing.
Yes, they are.
Thank you to Bobby Oliver for putting this together every year.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it, and I hope to see you on Sunday.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you to Valerie Manzi for that report. And that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi there, this is Brian, host of The Secret Show. Friday nights at 9. I'll be playing a mix of indie, alternative, college, rock, and pop. Some new music and some old classics. That's The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9, only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, cloudy, not as warm. A shower or two in places this afternoon, high 72. A brief shower or two this evening, maybe some late night showers too, low 60. Tomorrow, a high 65, cloudy. And then Saturday, high 72 with heavy thunderstorms in the afternoon. Warmer Sunday with a few showers, high 79. It's 11 o'clock.